Good morning. So hopefully you're here for CS30-30, computer architecture. So we're gonna talk about how computers are built. We're gonna kind of go down the layers of abstraction from what you saw in the most detail in 2150 and other courses. We kind of did a preview of some of this in 2150. We're gonna do some more detail. And we're gonna go down to sort of how we construct hardware rather than just how machine language works. We're gonna use, in some ways, C. So you hopefully kind of, sort of, have seen C. We're not gonna do much C programming. We're mainly using C sort of as an illustrative language because I want to show you things in something that is, you know, more expressive than assembly, and C is a good choice for that. And you probably kind of knew C++, and C is simpler than C++, so hopefully less to think about. And C has a direct correspondence to assembly. And what I mean by that is that we can take some C code, and there is a way to translate it to assembly that is pretty mindless. That there's just a bunch of rules you could have, and you could make assembly from the C and not need to make any weird, complicated decisions. And this is the primary reason why we're using C instead of, say, Python, because explaining how Python like gets translated to assembly, well, there's a lot more choices that need to be made, a lot of extra things going on. With C, there's this pretty straightforward translation. And our goal is mostly not going to be to do C or even assembly programming, but is to sort of understand the underlying machine and having something that's higher level where we can figure out how it goes down those layers is going to be useful for that. But I want to give you a warning. Even though we're going to be using sort of C examples to kind of illustrate this is what the machine's going to see, this isn't actually how C compilers work. So C compilers could use this very straightforward translation, but that's not the fastest thing you can do. And a lot of people have spent a lot of work on making C compilers produce the most efficient code possible. And when they're doing that, often you'll do things that are maybe not the most direct way to translate the C to assembly. They might do something that is very non-intuitive. And we're going to kind of ignore that mostly for this class. We're using C, assuming, like, to show the intuitive translations. But I want you to be aware that just because I say, oh, when you do plus equals in C, that turns into an add instruction, that doesn't mean the compiler actually needs to work that way. And it might, in fact, not work that way. Okay. And because we're doing some things with C, you're going to need some sort of Unix-like environment that has access to a C compiler. Our officially supported recommendation is machines managed by the department. So you can SSH into portal, or we have remote desktop to department machines via the NX remote desktop client. There are instructions off the course website for this week's lab. There's no actual in-person lab. I don't have all my TA schedules set up. And also there's some people probably joining the course and such, but that's those instructions are in that first lab. If you were registered for the course yesterday, you should definitely have a department account set up. If you registered since then, I'm gonna have to send another batch of names to the IT staff. And I should say that the department machines are what we will officially support, but many students end up using their own machines, and that's perfectly fine. There's some assignments where that might be especially tricky. And generally, you know, if you can't get a VM working on your machine, most of the time I and our TAs are gonna say, well, I don't really have time to spend 20 minutes with you doing IT stuff. We're gonna teach you how to use the department machines via remote access. So questions about sort of C versus assembly and sort of that we need sort of this Unix-like environment. We're all set. No. Or everyone's shot. One of the two. Okay. And yes, it says assignments will mostly work on the department machines. We'll work on the department machines definitely, but they may work on other machines. We're just not gonna do tech support for that unless, you know, we really have time. So I said the reason we're talking about C is because we really want to talk about sort of the lower levels. And C and other quote-unquote higher-level languages, usually wouldn't consider C a high-level language, but for this class, kind of where we're looking, we're going to say it is. And that gets translated to assembly, and the assembly we're going to use in this class is 64-bit x86 assembly, mainly just because you already know it, also because our textbook uses it. And I say you already know it. I've taught this class a bunch. I know that that's kind of more of a theoretical thing. That you have done stuff with the assembly, but many people have not remembered that very well through time or I don't know what. But so we're going to be spending some time reviewing it. Also, our textbook uses the other syntax for x86 assembly, the so-called AT&T syntax, which is not what you spent the most time with in 2150, so we're going to talk about that. But let's just see what people know. So here I have a simple C function, x plus y plus z, x, y, and z are global variables, just returns that, and I have assembly versions of it in both AT&T and Intel syntax. As far as I know, these are correct version translations from one syntax to the other. My question is which, if any, of these are correct. And you can discuss with your neighbors if you agree, and if you think they're incorrect, it'd be nice to know what does it actually do. I'll give you a minute or so. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who? Yeah, some people. You want an answer or more time? Let's do a show of hands. Who thinks A?
B?
Okay. C, both A and B are correct? Or D, neither of them are correct? Okay, so we have most people say B, and some people say neither. And I believe the correct answer is B. So glad that it seems like most people realize that there's a big problem with A. Someone tell me, what's the big problem with A? What does A do that doesn't make sense? Yeah. So it adds to the memory address. So where is a memory address in here, in A? RAX plus Y, so you're saying, oh, RAX plus Y here, this is computing a memory address. And that's correct. So what it's doing is basically this instruction is RAX gets RAX plus memory at RAX plus whatever the address of Y is. And you might say, well, what would that mean? And a way we can look at it is that if we think of Y as the beginning of an array, it's kind of doing an array lookup on Y, which is not anything like what the C code we started with does with Y. Well, it doesn't treat Y like an array, but that's what that add instruction is doing. Because we're doing that for the memory lookup, and the same with the next add with Z. So there's some things that both of these examples are doing right that may have been sort of sources of wondering what's going on, making things, maybe you thinking that both of these are wrong. So one thing is that RAX is in the calling convention we're going to use in this class, the return value register. So to return something, what do? We make sure that its value is in RAX before the function returns. And both of these put something in RAX before the function returns and pretty much don't manipulate any other values. Oh, but there is something, a reason why you might think that D is probably more correct. So there's something I did wrong here. So does someone have a reason why they wanted D? Yes. So your question is, isn't there something wrong with how we're passing variables to this function? So because x, y, and z are globals, presumably the way we're accessing them is that we just are going to hard code the memory address. So in this assembly, we didn't do that, though. We wrote x, y, and z. But we're going to learn what's going to happen when we translate this assembly to machine code is that we're going to insert the actual memory location that x, y, and z are going to be placed at in the machine code, where there's x, y, and z. Does that explain things? So there is something I did here, which is a little, which might make D a good answer. Someone, tell me what it is. There's a good reason you could have chosen D. So your question is, I didn't clear the return register. This move instruction should set the whole return register. So that solves that. But indeed, if I was adding into RAX for the first instruction, that would not work, even though it might sometimes work, which would be very confusing. Yeah? You have? Oh, so the question is, don't I have to declare X, Y, and Z? Yeah, so not shown here is I have to say what X, Y, and Z are probably. And do that. Hopefully it's elsewhere in this assembly file. Okay, so the thing that I did, which is maybe doesn't make sense, is that this is an int, and this is RAX. And ints on the systems we're going to be using are usually 4 bytes. And RAX is usually 8 bytes. So that is a reason why I would accept D as an answer. It probably works to treat everything as 8 bytes and just ignore the top 4 bytes, but probably should have not used RAX here. Okay. So questions? Yeah. So question, what would the proper register instead of RAX be? It would be to use EAX, which is, as we'll talk about next week, probably, or tomorrow, probably, Thursday, you know, is the lower 32 bits of REX. But as far as correctness, probably actually, you know, it produces the right answer in the sense that if you ignore the top bits of REX, it's probably correct. Okay. So that's a little review of assembly. So questions, other questions about other things in this example? Okay. So we're also going to talk about machine code. And something you might notice on this, you know, list of the sort of components we're going to be looking at as our specific examples is that for machine code, I wrote Y86. You might say, what is that? And that's the toy assembly, the subset of x86 assembly and a corresponding invented machine code our textbook has. You might say, why aren't we using real x86-64 machine code? And we could do that. But real x86-64 machine code has all sorts of complications that are not interesting, but are a lot of work to deal with. And the main reason for this is that basically there's this old processor with only 16-bit registers, and then they converted to have 32-bit registers, and then 64-bit registers. And as they were doing this, they said, let's make this machine code not change very much. And kind of the result of that is that the machine code has lots of weirdly organized things that I don't want to teach. So we're going to teach this invented machine code, which is much cleaner and also has a lot less stuff. It's not going to support all the instructions that we see in x86-64 assembly, but that's going to be fine, especially because we're going to have a sequence of assignments where we're going to make, in a simulator, a processor that supports that machine code. And for that, you know, you're going to be happy to have a much simpler assembly language, even though, you know, assembly language is harder to code things in. So it's a subset of x86-64 that's supported, and it's much, much simpler than the real coding. But it is considerably more complicated than IBCM, which you may or may not remember from 2150. So like, it supports multiple registers, instructions take up a variable number of bytes, it has conditional jumps and stack manipulation instructions, a bunch of things you didn't really see in IBCM. Okay, so then we have something that we haven't seen before, and that's going to be what something called, we call a hardware design language. So if we're making hardware, one way you might imagine making hardware is you pick up a bunch of hardware components and you physically connect them, and then you have hardware. And this is a thing we can do, and we can do sort of a, you know, computer-based equivalent of this, where we're like, we have a program where basically we draw out the hardware. And there are programs like that. And in fact, prior versions of this course have used programs like that. But a more common way of making hardware like processors is to have basically a programming language that looks kind of like the programming languages you're used to for software, where instead of compiling down to machine code or being interpreted, we have a way of compiling it down to a description of here's how you build a piece of hardware, here's how you connect all the components. And we're going to work with one of those. So we're not going to work with an industrial version of this. We're going to work with a sort of teaching hardware design language, but it's rather similar to the kinds of things that you would use in industry if you were doing this, just missing a bunch of things that are complicated we don't want to talk about. So we're going to write this sort of textual description of the circuit we want to produce. And the idea is that in an industrial environment, there would be a compiler which takes this to a here's how you build the circuit description that someone could use to make an actual physical processor. So questions about hardware description languages? And the hardware description language we used is based on the one in our textbook. And for the assignments that use it. We're going to be following our textbook most closely. For the other parts of the course, a lot less closely. But that's the primary reason why I strongly recommend having access to a copy of the textbook for those assignments. Okay. And if we're talking about hardware description languages, we need to talk about sort of what's the hardware that we're describing. And below that, I've listed sort of gates, transistors, wires, and registers. And we're not going to, like, talk in this class about how does a transistor work, how do you build an AND gate, and so on. We'll talk a little bit about sort of bit manipulation. But for the most part, we're going to be dealing with this at a higher level of abstraction. We're going to say, I'm assuming someone knows how to make a circuit that adds two numbers together, and I'm going to use that to build my processor. I'm not going to worry about how do I make something that adds two numbers together. You know, the thing problem we're going to worry about is how do I make sure I add the right two numbers together and get the result where the instruction I read says put it. That's the part we're going to be spending all our time on. And we're going to talk about building processors. And it's worth talking about what do processors actually do. And sort of our simple model of a computer is we have a processor, a central processing unit sometimes, connected to some storage. The most usable, immediately usable storage is what we call memory. And I have pictures here of a die photo of a processor. So this is a microscope photo of a processor with its case removed. If you've seen a physical processor, usually there's something over this. You can't see this sort of detail. And this is probably really teeny. But this is the actual sort of, you can see the circuitry of the CPU. We have these bunch of these regular structures. We'll learn that this later on in the semester that these are caches, these regular structures here. And the stuff over here has some other caches and some stuff that actually does the computation. And yeah, that doesn't actually take up most of the processor. We'll talk about that later in the semester. But this processor is connected to memory because it doesn't really store things itself. It accesses storage elsewhere. And there's some connection between the processor and memory, which we'll call, for this class, a bus. That's not the only way of building it, but we'll say that there's a connection we'll call a bus between the CPU and processor that's bidirectional. And sort of in a more abstract version, the processor has a little bit of storage on it, typically the things that you know in assembly language as registers. And one of them is going to be what we'll call a program counter, or sometimes an instruction pointer. And that's saying, where is the machine code I want to execute? So let's say our program counter has value 4043, and that's the address of the machine code we want to execute. And if the processor wants to execute that machine code, well, it doesn't actually store most of the data. That's in the memory. So it's going to have to use this two-way communication bus to ask the memory, hey, what's that address 4043? Because I want to execute that, so it needs to ask the memory for it. And the memory is going to send a message back, oh, hey, it's, you know, this move instruction. And in practice, probably it doesn't actually send back the move instruction in this format. It's in machine code. But I'd like us to be able to understand what's going on, so I didn't write the machine code for that move instruction. So then the processor is going to have some circuitry in there that looks at that thing it got back from the memory and does what it says. In this case, it's going to store in RAX, a register it has, the value 42. This move instruction would, in Intel syntax, this would be move RAX, 42. And this means that in addition to having our program counter, we also have storage for the registers that we normally use in what we'll call a register file. Okay. And then after we're done with that, the processor needs more work to do. So where is it going to find more work to do? Well, we're going to have to go to the next piece of machine code to run. And for this instruction, well, where is that going to be? So how would you find, if you were looking at an assembly file, how would you find out what piece of machine code or what instruction runs after this move? Where would you look for it? Yeah?
The next thing in the stack.
So if we're thinking of assembly file, it's the next thing in the assembly file. So how is that actually stored? Well, it's not on the stack as we know it. It's just the next thing, the next instruction in memory. So we're going to look at where the machine code we got this move instruction from is and find the thing out, the machine code after that. So in this case, we're going to add something, whatever the length of that move instruction was, to our program counter. And we have the address of the thing afterwards. And then we're going to repeat the process with that address looking for whatever machine code is there. So we're going to say, OK, now what's at this next address, the one after that move? We're going to get a different instruction. In this case, let's say we got a push. So to run this push instruction, we're going to have to write a value to the stack. So how do we know where the stack is? Yeah? So memory, so the stack is in memory. How do we know where in memory it is? Because every time we talk to memory, you have to give memory an address. You have to give it a number to say exactly where. You can't just tell memory write to the stack, because memory doesn't actually track where the stack is, just like it doesn't track where the program counter is. It doesn't know. All memory knows is that if you give it a number, it gives you back a value. Yeah? RSP. So we have a register for that. So in our register file, in that dot, dot, dot there, there's going to be a value of RSP. So I have a value of RSP. And to run this instruction, I'm going to look at the value of RSP and use that to figure out where I write to. And if we want to write to a value in memory, just like when we read, we're going to have to tell the memory, hey, please set this value to a particular thing. So in this case, we're going to say RSP was FFF0, write 42 to it. And also, we're going to change RSP because it's push, and that changes where our current stack location is. And hopefully, I did that in the correct direction in this example. And after we've done that, well, we've run the push instruction. What do we do next? Same thing we did before. We're going to go to the next piece of machine code in memory. So we're going to add to our program counter again and ask for the next piece of machine code. So this sort of loop where we fetch some machine code from the memory, do whatever that says, possibly communicating with the memory to like get values or set values in the memory, and then go to the next piece of machine code, that's what our processor does. We're going to talk about how do we build a circuit that does this task and does it for all the instructions, not just these examples. So questions sort of about this setup? So the question is there a reason I incremented the program counter by different amounts of bytes? And that's because as in the machine code we're going to learn, the instructions take up variable amounts of bytes. And so based on how long the instruction is, we'll figure out where the following instructions start. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, why did RSP go back to FFF0 instead of staying FFF8? That is a typo. Or that is something changing on the wrong slide. That is an error. Sorry. So this should be push. What direction should it be? Hopefully it's
It should become, it should go, no, oh, sorry, it should go to FFF0 because when we push, the thing we push is the new top of the stack. Okay. So it was FFF8 and then it became FFF0. So this is the new top of stack. Yes. Question, that's assuming that the stack grows downwards? Yes. And I'm going to do that because we're basting things on 64-bit x86. That's the convention on 64-bit x86. You could absolutely make a processor, and there are processors out there where the stack grows in the other direction. Okay, other questions? Okay. So we have our processor memory, and a way we can think of what memory is memory is just an array, basically. It's a big array that we can access. And we typically think of memory as an array with a value for each byte, even though when we're talking to memory from the processor, usually we retrieve multiple of those bytes at a time. So when the processor asks for, one of those machine code addresses, it usually gets a whole bunch of bytes there because the instruction is not just one byte. But ultimately, all memory is doing is managing this array. Some questions? Memory? Okay, so there's something here we're missing. So I've sort of shown you a working computer, you have a processor and memory, but as far as being useful, we're missing some things. What's something we're missing? Something very important that you would not find this machine useful without. Yeah. Cache. So we'll talk about cache later, but cache is going to be just making things faster. So don't care about, the thing I'm worried about missing is not like it's slow. It just doesn't do things we need to do. Yes?
Human interaction.
There's no way of actually communicating with this machine. It has no input or output devices. There's no keyboard, there's no monitor, there's no network connection. The only way I could communicate with this machine is if I had like another connection to the memory and I could flip bits in it and read bits out of it. And maybe that's something we could do, but that's not very useful. It's not what we expect from a computer. So we also need some way of talking to what we'll call I/O devices. And one way we could hack that up is we could say, we're still going to have only one connection out of the processor. We're just going to have, sometimes it goes to memory, and sometimes it goes to I/O devices. And we have this component I call an I/O bridge, which decides which goes where. And how would we do that? One way we could do it is we could just say some addresses go to I/O devices, some go to memory, and not change anything else about how the processor works. So with the processor, in this model, if the processor wants to talk to a keyboard, it does the same thing it would do to read from memory, except it chooses an address that belongs to the keyboard instead of one that belongs to memory. Another way we could do this design is we could say, let's have just two outputs from the processor, one for I/O devices and one for memory. And this is kind of more what our textbook presents. I usually show this prior diagram because I think it's probably closer to how modern processors work. That we'll just say we have this memory bus output, but we can in fact connect more than memory to it. We just need a way for the processor to get things from external memories or I/O devices and send things to them. And if we can send things to memory, we can use the same protocol to send things to like a display. Some questions about connecting our processor to external devices? Okay, so we've seen this model for how
how memory and the processor interact. Let's make sure we sort of have an idea of what gets communicated over this bus from the processor to memory. So let's say we're executing this instruction here. And I've shown it in both syntaxes, which reads a value from memory into RAX. My question is, how many times does the processor send a message to the memory to execute this? So I'll give you a minute, check with your neighbors, make sure you agree on times are. Okay, who'd like more time? Okay, so who thinks we have one or more time? One or more. Okay, two or more. Okay, three or more. Couple. Four or more. Okay. Eight or more. Okay, so. So it seems like we have most agree with my answer. So the answer I got was 2. Let's show how I'm counting. So what I think happens for this instruction is first the processor has to ask, hey, memory, get me the values at this instruction's address. And it gets the machine code for the instruction. Then the processor is going to look at that machine code and say, oh, wait a moment, to finish this instruction, you know, I can access RAX without talking to the memory, that's in the processor, but I need to ask about what's the value at this memory address. So it's going to ask the memory, hey, what's at address 123400? And the memory is going to do that. And then you might say, wait a moment, but you showed this important extra step where we increment the program counter and find the next instruction. And I agree that that is something that's going to happen, but that's the next part of the next instruction. So other questions, comments, points of confusion here? Yes. So question, let's say instead of reading into RAX, we were writing from RAX to memory, would it be 3 times? And if we were writing from RAX to memory, what would change here is instead of asking for what's at that address, we'd say set 0x124002 some value. And the processor wouldn't have to ask the memory for that value because it had it stored in that register file, which we saw in our picture, was in the processor itself. So there'd be no extra communication. It would just be a different thing where the processor really wouldn't care about a response from that second message. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, does that mean that every access to memory counts as an instruction for the processor memory? So I'll call this a message or a bus access to memory or something like that. I wouldn't call it an instruction because I'm going to try to only use the word instruction to refer to assembly instructions. Just to be consistent, even though, yes, we can call a bunch of other things instructions, but try to use only that word for it. Does that answer your question? And I guess I should say I'm simplifying things a little bit here because we're kind of assuming at this point that every time we want to access something from memory, we have to send a message outside the processor. When we talk about caches later on, we'll learn that that's not quite true, but we're going to have this simpler model for the first half of the class or so. We're going to start with the non-optimized version, but there's going to be some optimizations that avoid some of these messages we'll talk about later on. Other questions, comments? Okay, so have a good model of it. Okay, so we're talking a bunch about how processors work. And something, I'm going to go over some logistics, but first I'm going to go over one of the bigger complaints I've gotten about this class, which is, gosh, I don't ever intend to build hardware. Why should I care about this class? Just tell me what I need to do to get a D minus so I can meet my BACS requirements and get me out of here. And we're going to try to make this relevant, even if you aren't, as most of you probably will not be, especially because you're not computer engineering majors, because this class is not the one computer engineering majors take. Things that are useful if you're not building hardware. So one thing we're going to talk a bunch about is program performance. And knowing how the processor works, well, that matters a lot for program performance. There's some things the processor does faster than other things, even if it might look similar in a higher level language. And one thing we're going to talk about when we talk about how processors work is we're going to get beyond the naive model of program performance. So the naive model of program performance is that, if I know how it goes to assembly, I know how fast it is, right? You just say, this is a lot of assembly instructions, therefore it's slow. This is a lot of assembly instructions, therefore it's fast. But that's a good start. Like, it's better than random guessing about performance most of the time, but there's a lot of reasons why this model doesn't actually work in practice. There's a lot of things that happen in processors where something could have a lot of instructions to run and be fast, or have few instructions to run but be slow. And there's two big reasons for this and how hardware is built that we're going to talk about both of them that affect this. So one is parallelism. So far, I've given you the impression that hardware takes one instruction, it does the whole instruction, goes on to the next instruction. And that's basically it. But hardware that is efficient, that your higher end processors, doesn't actually work that way. It does multiple things at once. And one of the things it does is it will run parts of different instructions at the same time. And you might say, okay, so it's doing that, great. That means that just my assembly code runs faster, right? And, well, yes, but not all your assembly code, because in order to do things at the same time, the hardware needs multiple things it can do at the same time. So if you can write your code so the hardware can find two things it can do at once, versus code where it has to do one thing before it can start the other, just because, you know, you can't add x plus y to z before you add x plus y, for example, you're going to have more efficient code. So we're going to think about that. And there's some other examples of where we can take advantage of hardware being able to do multiple things at once, where we might have to be more explicit. Like, for example, most processors have instructions which will not just add two values, but add like 16 different values at once. And if you can use those, that's going to be a lot more efficient, hopefully. Another big phenomenon in how hardware is built is caching. So it turns out that accessing that memory, sending those messages, is super slow. And to avoid that sort of slowness, processors are built to keep local fast copies of things that have been recently used. So this means that accessing things that have been recently accessed is faster. And if you take advantage of this, your code will run a lot faster because you're going to be accessing these faster storage than just talking to the memory all the time. If you don't take advantage of this, your code will run much slower, even though it's the same number of instructions, because each of those instructions will be sending messages to the memory when they wouldn't otherwise. So these are sort of two big performance-related topics we'll talk about. And these are things which are complementary to algorithmic efficiency. So in most of the other classes, you talk about sort of more abstract ideas of efficiency, and that's like big O, you know, quadratic versus log linear and so on. And that's still important, and usually the first thing you should worry about. But worrying about optimizing parallelism and caching is something you can do in addition to algorithmic efficiency, which will give you sort of a big additional benefit. Sort of as a practical thing you can do after you've said, oh, you know, I'm already using the right big O, why is it still slow? This is sort of where you start solving that problem. Some questions about general program performance motivations? Okay, so another thing we're going to talk about is how compilers work. You've used compilers, you don't have no idea how they work. You've seen assembly code generated by compilers in 2150, assuming we still do that. But we're going to talk a little more about how compilers work, in particular, how separate compilation works. And this might be useful, like, if you have weird compiler linker errors, you might have a better idea what's actually going on in that case. Or if you want to make compilers, that's something some of you might want to do. Or just for debugging, because often with debugging, you're realizing, like, why is my code working this way when I wrote this thing? You'll have more idea, hopefully, about, you know, why your compiler might have generated some weird assembly code for your program. Another thing we're going to talk about is sort of exceptional case handling in processors. So one thing processors need to deal with is, like, what if a program I'm writing accesses some crazy memory location? And typically this manifests as things like seg faults. And if you're taking 2150, most of you have probably seen a seg fault, even though I don't think that's a formal assignment in 2150. And we're going to talk about sort of what's going on in the processor, you know, why it would be the case that sometimes you access something that's invalid and get a seg fault and sometimes you don't. So we're going to have a better understanding of those sorts of issues. You know, that's useful both for, you know, knowing, you know, why is my program crashing sometimes and not, or if you want to build operating systems which need to deal with how do I run programs that might access a crazy memory location out of bounds. And how can that be done safely and so on. That's another big topic we'll talk about. So questions about our general things I hope you learned that aren't just how to build processors. And why you might want to care about this course, even if you're going to, you think you're never going to use it again. So I'm going to do a bit of logistics. We'll get back to talking about memory. So lectures and lab, I'm not planning on checking attendance. Labs will be electronic submission that's possible to do, you know, submit without talking to anyone, but we'll have labs will be staffed, except not this week. This week, there's no one in the lab. You can go there, but no one will be there. No course staff, at least. But we're not going to check attendance. Remote submission of labs is possible, but we'd hope you go to lab to have help from TAs, and well, I'm not checking lecture attendance, but I'd hope you go to like ask questions and make sure I don't go too fast, things like that. If you really don't want to attend lecture, hey, you figure out what works for you. But based on how people have had problems in the past, if you aren't attending lecture for whatever reason and using lecture recordings, I strongly recommend having some sort of regular schedule. Please don't do the, I'm going to watch the lectures just before the assignment that needs them is due. That usually works out poorly for people. Like maybe it will work for you, but most people, not a good thing. I recommend, you know, trying to like, when I ask exercise in lecture, like pause if you're watching the recording and like actually do it. And if you have questions while you're watching a lecture, like write them down and you can ask them in office hours, on Piazza, or something like that. I'm very happy to answer questions about lecture material, regardless of whether you attended lecture or not, in office hours and the like. So, that's on attendance. So, coursework-wise. So we have labs. So labs are graded very loosely. They're mainly intended to introduce homework assignments. So there's none this week. And labs are graded, so there's some threshold, which I hope is something that most of the time would be just could happen naturally within the lab time for essentially everybody. That gives you full credit. So my intention is, even though you don't have to do the labs during the lab time, is that if you go to lab, spend 75 minutes on it, that should almost always get you full credit. I'm grading based on what you submit, so that won't be 100% true. You know, if we're doing a lab and you somehow submit nothing that does anything, probably I can't give you credit for it because it doesn't look like you spent 75 minutes working on it. At least not full credit. I'll probably give you partial credit. Collaboration for labs is permitted. You can work with whoever you like in the lab, in other labs, talk to TAs, and they're actually due by 11:59 p.m. on the lab day. We have homework assignments, and most homework assignments are sort of based on the previous lab. There might be a few exceptions. Those are to be done individually. So please, not sharing code, pseudocode, etc. with other students. Sort of high-level discussion is okay, but you know, I shouldn't look at what you submitted and say, obviously you and you two people were doing the same thing. And they're due by 9:30 a.m. the lab day, or 9:30 a.m., that's the time of the first lab. Because just as a policy, I don't want to have my lab TAs mostly be helping people on the homework. They're supposed to be there helping you in the lab, so that's why they're due before the first lab. There will also be weekly quizzes. So these will be released after lecture on Thursday in the evening, not immediately after the last lecture, so I have time to revise the quiz if we don't get to things, if I don't ask you questions about things we didn't cover. And they will be due before the first lecture on Tuesday. So, and I'll show how that works online. Next lecture, it's untimed, online, quizzes that are mostly auto-graded after every week. We'll do a demo next time. And there will be a final exam. I will decide in the format of that sometime later. Yes?
Are the quizzes closed or open notes?
Question, are the quizzes closed or open? The quizzes are open note, open lecture recordings, open internet. The general rule for collaboration of the quizzes is that you should not be asking the quiz questions to other people. You know, not that sort of help. Like, you can talk about the subject generally. Our TAs are not going to answer the quiz questions for you, but if you like want to go over a similar lecture example with the TAs, that's fine. Or a similar textbook example, that's fine, but we're not going to answer the quiz questions before the quizzes are due, but we'll discuss them. Yeah, and like, don't ask the quiz question on Stack Overflow or something. Things like that. Other logistics questions? That's on that. I mentioned we have a textbook, mostly for the HTL assignment. I think it's useful for other topics, but not as good for many of those other topics. I'll note that in doing the scheduled Tetris, usually, you know, labs and homeworks aren't quite synchronized with lectures, mostly because I don't want to have you have to do a lab on something before we've actually covered in the lecture. So I'm trying to avoid that, but this means that sometimes the actual homework on something might be like a week or two after we covered in lecture, depending on how things work out. Okay, so I mentioned quizzes. So release Thursday night, do Tuesday before the first lecture. And for the most part, quizzes will be about the lecture material for that week. And the two lowest quiz grades will be dropped. And there is a late policy. Generally, if you have some sort of unusual circumstance, like being ill, you know, some important event you need to go to, something like that, contact me. I'll often figure things out, especially if I have advanced notice, so we can like help you start things early or something, you know, other sorts of arrangements like that. But there's a no questions asked late policy for homeworks, which is that if it's 0 to 48 hours late, it's minus 10%. If it's 48 to 72 hours late, it's minus 15%. If it's more late than that, unless you have an exception with me, it's no credits. I will grade it for you, but you're not going to get credit for it. And for quizzes and labs, we generally will not accept late submissions, except in exceptional circumstance. The primary reason for this is that very often we will release actual solutions for the quizzes and labs. And obviously, if I've posted a solution for a lab or a quiz, I can't really accept your submissions in most cases. And on getting help. So for non-real-time help, I'm planning on using Piazza. It's my recommendation for like searchable help. For labs, we have them in person, and you can certainly ask non-lab questions if the TAs have time. TAs will probably prioritize the lab help on the actual lab. And for office hours, they will be on the website on the calendar. I have one posted for tomorrow. We're still figuring out when TAs are available and when I'm available and all that, so we'll have them posted for next week probably, but for the first week, there'll be some, usually probably with me, but they'll be pretty minimal. Office hours are going to be a mix of in-person and remote. So remote ones, we'll use Discord, just as basically a better Zoom, because using Zoom with multiple TAs is actually really awkward. And whether it's remote or in-person will be noted on the schedule. Our plan is that remote times are like late evenings or lower demand days, probably Thursday and Friday morning, and otherwise probably in person. So we want to have some remote times. We're gonna not schedule like remote and in person at the same time, because that creates really horrible incentives. Don't want anyone sitting in in-person office hours with Discord open, talking to people. That's not good. And there's an office hour queue for remote office hours. I'm mentioning this because I get complaints about it. Our hope is that the queue doesn't matter because there will be so much help that it won't wait very long. But I know that probably won't end up happening, at least sometimes during the semester, as hard as I've tried to hire TAs. So the queue is sorted by last time helped, and we can reset things. Last time helped, but first three slots in first come, first served. With the first three slots in first come, first served, we might reset that first three slots. So if you join the queue like before an office hour overnight, we might reset that. Please do not try to reserve spaces like that. We will just make it not work. Yeah. It's linked off the main websites.
Okay.
So, and I'm mentioning some in-person office hours. In-person office hours, we should have something written on a whiteboard or something indicating, you know, write your name here or use the queue. And for smaller office hours, we probably won't bother with the queue. But, you know, things might get, if things get big enough, we might do that. For remote office hours, it makes sense to use that. I need to fix this slide because I edited down the slide without reading the second bullet. Yeah, but we have a queue and it's basically ordered by when you were last helped, with the first few slots being, you know, actual reserve numbers. And we might reset that, but, you know, just to make people not surprised. But as I said, like, the ideal situation is that the queue doesn't matter because we have enough office hour help. Okay. And I guess I should say, our first lab and homework will be assembly stuff, so-called bomb lab and homework. Basically, we're going to give you a program, and using a debugger / disassembler, you figure out what the correct input is, so you're going to be looking at assembly to do that from the disassembler in the debugger. And we're going to talk a bunch about assembly in the next few lectures to help review that, but you're really sketchy on that, you might want to review yourself. Okay. So questions about logistics? Should go here. Okay, so let's go on to another topic. So mentioned memory, and I said that memory is an array of bytes. So we can think of memory as this big array of bytes with, you know, we have a label for each of those bytes, which is an address. And I can draw this in a bunch of ways, but it's an array of bytes. And for this class, a byte is 8 bits. Yes, you might know some other places where a byte isn't 8 bits. Here, it's always 8 bits. And I can draw this array in a bunch of ways, and it's still the same thing. So I'd like to emphasize that. So sometimes I might have the higher numbers at the top of the page. Sometimes I might have the higher numbers at the bottom of the page. It's still the same values, still the same contents. No actual difference. Because what matters when we're accessing it is, you know, sort of what number we're supplying. Now, there is something that we need to deal with in figuring out how we access this memory, which is that what I showed you is that the processor asks, hey, what's at address, you know, 1000? And it gets a value which is bigger than one byte. Like, our machine code was typically more than one byte, it looked like, based on how the program counter was changing. And we need to decide, well, when we're getting a value that's multiple bytes, what value is that? How do we construct that from the several bytes? And this is endianness, which you have probably seen in 2150, but we definitely need to go over based on my past experience teaching this class. So here I have sort of a simple example of endianness in C. So I have a pointer which contains the address 42000. And generally what we're going to do in pretty much, no matter what choice we make about endianness, is that to retrieve an int, which is 4 bytes, on the systems we use, so this is, we're going to assume that this is 4 bytes, we're gonna take these bytes here and interpret them as one number. And there's multiple ways we could do that. So one way is that we could say that the value at the lowest address, 42000, is the least significant part. And another is we could say it's the most significant part. And we get very different answers depending which we choose. The first option is little endian, and this is what we're going to be assuming in this class because it's what x86 has chosen to do. Second option is big endian. And note that what matters is sort of how, you know, is that we have these bytes. Those are the units we're arranging. We're not ever like changing the order of a byte. We're always keeping the byte in order because it's stored as a whole unit, right? We know when we have a particular byte that it's one, you know, with the least significant bit set versus the most significant bit set. That's kind of built into the memory. The memory knows how bytes are ordered internally. We don't have to worry about that. There's no way of saying, you know, give me part one of a byte. All we can say is give me the, you know, least significant part of a byte or the most significant part. So we don't have to worry about, you know, anything within a byte. We have to worry about how do we organize those bytes. That's endian. So we're going to use little endian in this class. So questions about sort of our concept of endianness before I do an exercise on it. So, yeah. Question, is there a difference in little endian and big endian where the values would be with respect to the addresses? So is your question whether in addition to accessing the byte at 42000, we'd access the one at say 41FFF? Or question, would the value 42000 be different in big endian versus little endian? So like the actual number 42000, is that different? Is that your question? Oh, so if I access one byte from 42000, does that change? No. So if we're only accessing one byte, because our memory is an array of bytes, we don't have to worry about any of this, right? It's a byte. The memory stores bytes. It doesn't store parts of bytes. So we don't have to worry about how do we combine things into a byte, because we start with a byte. Does that answer your question? So endianness only comes up when we have multiple units we need to combine into one thing. And where this most often happens in our machines is we have a bunch of bytes we need to combine into one bigger number. Other questions? Okay. So here I have a little example of C code, which I'm going to run through before we talk about this. So I have an 8-byte buffer, which I've drawn a picture of here, which we'll use later. And I have two 32-bit values. And I get pointers to both of these values as a pointer to a byte. So I have a pointer to the byte of the first byte, the byte with the lowest address of each of those two 32-bit integers. And what I do here is in this first loop, I copy byte by byte from value 1 into the first part of the buffer. So this is going to be I0, 1, 2, 3. And from value 2 into the second part of the buffer, this is going to be 4, 5, 6, 7. And then I copy from the buffer back into value 1, starting at 1, 2, 3, 4. Questions about sort of what the code does mechanically? Sort of what bytes are copied where? Okay, so with that, question is, what does value 1 become? So what are we copying into value 1? How is that going to be interpreted as a number, given that we're little endian? And you can check with your neighbors. I would write things down personally. If you can do it in your head, that's fine too, but it seems hard. Okay, so because we're out of time, I usually ask for more. I assume some people need more time, but because we're out of time, we're just going to say well now. So who thinks A? B? C? Okay, a couple. D? E? F? G? Okay, H? I? No clue? Okay, so you have a mix of no clue and G. G is the correct answer, but I'm gonna go through what this looks like. Oh, I should have shown this diagram, but. So what we do is we take these two numbers and we copy them into the buffer. So our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 is represented as 7, 8, 5, 6, 3, 4, 1, 2. Those are the sequence of bytes and hexadecimal, starting with the lowest address. Because little endian means the lowest address is the least significant part. Least significant part is the ones place. This is where the 8 is. So that's in that byte there. And we copy them into the buffer, and we get our first number, its sequence of bytes in the buffer. So the 7, 8 is first because that's the least significant part of it. Then our second number, the F0 is first because that's the least significant part of that. Then we copy from the 1 through 4 to get our number. So we interpret that as a little endian number. And so we have 5, 6 in the least significant part, then 3, 4, then 1, 2, then F0. And that's how we get our final value of F0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So questions about that? Okay, so I am out of time. See you on Thursday. And I'll be here to answer other inquiries.